For 20 years, Grassy Narrows has blockaded.
Early in December, about 40 First Nation residents blocked logging roads to protect their hunting, trapping, and fishing rights.
Demonstrated.
That's why they're afraid, because they know what they're doing to us is wrong.
Drummed.
That's just a snippet from a new video. It was released this week to celebrate the anniversary of a blockade started by Grassy Narrows First Nation 20 years ago to this very day. There's a community gathering to mark the anniversary, and leading up to it, the CBC's Logan Turner spoke to a number of people involved with the blockade from the very beginning, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So remind us, Logan, about the impact this blockade had on logging around Grassy Narrows.
Right. I'm not going to talk too much this morning. I want you to hear the stories from the women that were involved in the blockade right from the beginning, as you mentioned, why it was so urgent 20 years ago and how it continues to be an important place and movement for Grassy Narrows today. But briefly, resource extraction of the lands around Grassy Narrows had been getting worse throughout the 1900s. Clear cutting in the area about 100 kilometers north of Kenora continued happening, and the pulp and paper industry dumped mercury into the waterways, resulting in mercury poisoning of people in the First Nation. It continued until the community decided to take a strong stand and to not let any more logging vehicles into their territory. The result, albeit years later in 2008, was one of the world's largest newsprint companies, Abitibi Bowater, gave up its license to the surrounding forest and agreed not to log without consent from the community. The blockade remains as they continue to guard their land against unwanted industry.
I remember all of that, and it's amazing to kind of go back there in your mind. Now, can you take us back to set the scene leading up to the blockade?
Yeah. So I spoke to Judy De Silva, who's from Grassy and spent many years acting as a spokesperson for the First Nation. That dates right back to the very beginning of the blockade. She described what it was like leading up to 2002.
We had been hearing from the hunters and the trappers that, you know, one weekend their hunting grounds were there, and then the following weekend the hunting grounds would be logged over and they'd have no more trap line. So that's kind of how it started. And then we had lived with the logging industry our whole lives, you know, like driving behind logging trucks, and, you know, it was just a part of our lives. But then when the feller buncher started being used, like taking the job of 10 men, the cutting became very rampant. And then they started cutting closer and closer to our community and then destroying the people's hunting grounds. And it started being very visual.
And so what was the catalyst that led to the actual blockade?
Right. So all throughout that time, Judy told me, people in the community had been writing letters, voicing their concerns to government, planning and preparing to take action. But then it was one night that really started the blockade. Here's Chrissy Isaacs telling me about a drive she took one night with her sister.
We were just having conversations, you know, about what the future is going to be like. And while we were talking, driving around, you know, talking about our kids, like how they might miss out on being able to hunt and pick berries and like to have that knowledge of the land. And as we're talking about that, like a big logging truck went by. And then I remember saying, we have to stop that. And she said, okay, let's do it. And so me and her went out with an anonymous person, and we put the logs over the road. And within like the next week or so, my uncle stepped up and made it happen. Like that's when the blockade officially started on December 2nd, 2002.
So that action of cutting down a log to block the road, that really started it.
That's what a lot of people have told me, although some people, Mary Jean, remember that story a little bit differently with a few more details. Here's Judy De Silva again.
Three young people, they went in the forest and they tried to cut trees down to block the road. And they said the first one went backwards, so it didn't go on the road. The second one went halfway on the road, but then their car broke down. They're way in the forest. It was in like the end of November, very cold. And then their car broke down. So their dad had to go help them, Robert Williamson. It was like 6 hours later. It was towards, you know, nighttime. And he went and found them and he helped them. So that was kind of like when Robert Williamson heard this, you know, this is his two daughters. He said, we're starting now.
So what did the blockade look like?
Well, my understanding is that at first it was just a sacred fire lit in the middle of the road, and then structures temporary at first started going up. People took turns as well, lying down on the road, turning logging trucks back, stopping them from entering the lands to continue to extract the trees. But there was also a lot of activity, people delivering eviction notices to loggers that had set up camp. One of those people was Barbara Fobister, who happens to also be Judy's sister. She told me about one of those trips, and what she told me was that it was, they were driving down, it was four women, and they were driving down the road, and it was a snowy day, and they kind of, they saw this tracks in the middle of the road, and they didn't really know what that was, so they were driving up trying to look for it, and all of a sudden they saw this large white wolf just running through, and they said that that for them was a moment that really solidified they were doing good work, that this was the right thing to do. But so it was just the four women, and then, two men joined up with them, and they were headed to this site where a bunch of loggers had set up camp. And as they were going, they were worried because it was just a handful of them going to deliver this eviction notice telling them to get out of their land. And as they got there, they knocked on the door. It was one of Barbara's sisters, Roberta, who knocked on the door. And when they opened it up, they said, you know, amidst all of this fear, they saw such a comical scene. It was all of these loggers just sitting there in their long johns watching a game of hockey. And they said that was just this moment where they just kind of like they were – it relaxed some of like the tension that was there because, they were – it was just such a comical scene for them. And so they delivered their eviction notice and they said, you know, you have 24 hours to get out. And then they kind of hopped in their car and they left and they kind of laughed about it afterwards. But sure enough, the next day, within 24 hours, all the loggers, she said, were gone.
Wow. So how has this blockade and its significance, I guess, changed over time?
Right. So you can hear the urgency at the time talking about the importance of stopping the logging, stopping that extraction in 2002. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, that urgency is still there. We've reported last year, you know, that Grassi has taken Ontario to court for granting 9 permits for mineral exploration on their lands without their consultation. But it's also this area has become quite built up. There's a wigwam and a teaching lodge. There's a Sundance site. There are sleeping cabins set up. Melissa Bunting is Barbara's daughter, and she says it's become a place for the community.
It almost feels like a home now when you go there. It's like a second home. You feel comfortable there. It's a place like where we all gather now for celebrations, like birthdays, or, you know, we go there just to sing, we go there for ceremonies, and then we have actions there still and gatherings. And so we go there and we sing songs, we bring our kids there, my girls come sing with me there now, and we're just carrying on the fight and the traditions with our young ones now.
And that, Mary Jean, is what will happen at the site today. There's a feast to remember what this blockade has meant for the community, what it still means, and like I mentioned, why it's so important to Grassy Narrows, still so urgent for them to protect their lands.
Wow. I'm sure there will be so many. I keep hearing stories and the voices and the stories, and I can only imagine the stories that will be told there today. Thank you so much for this, Logan. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The CBC's Logan Turner.